Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing likelihood that the Russian airliner that crashed into the Sinai was brought down by a bomb aboard, making early claims by the Islamic State that they blew up the plane in retaliation for the Russian bombing of their fighters in Syria increasingly credible. Gordon Hahn, a professor and researcher in the Monterey Terrorism Research and Education Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, and the author of the new book, The Caucasus Emirate and Mujahideen, Global Jihadism in Russia's North Caucasus and Beyond, joins us. We will discuss the possible blowback that Putin is facing from his intervention in Syria at home, where there is already an ongoing war with Islamist insurgents in the Caucasus. Then the author of the new book, The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin, Stephen Lee Myers, joins us in the studio. He has worked for The New York Times for 26 years, seven of them in Russia during the period when Putin consolidated his power, and we will discuss how Putin and the Russian media he controls will handle the terrorist downing of the Russian passenger jet, as well as try to understand what motivates Russia's new Tsar, who Forbes magazine just listed as the most powerful man in the world. And finally, we will examine how the oil industry pumped money into the California legislature to kill a bill that would have halved petroleum consumption by cars and trucks in the state by 2030. Adrienne Alvord, the Union of Concerned Scientists California and Western States Director, joins us to discuss Governor Brown's angry retort that, quoting, oil won the skirmish, but they've lost the bigger battle, and her article at the Union of Concerned Scientists, Oil Industry Money Buying Too Much Influence in California. And joining us now is Gordon Hahn, who is a professor and researcher in the Terrorism Research and Education Program at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies at Monterey. He has taught at several universities in the United States and as a Fulbright Scholar at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. And his books include Russia's Islamic Threat, and his latest book is The Caucasus Emirate and Mujahideen, Global Jihadism in Russia's North Caucasus and Beyond. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gordon Hahn.
Hello, Ian. Thanks for having me again.
And Gordon, there seems to be an increasing likelihood that the Russian passenger jet that crashed a few days ago in the Sinai was brought down by a bomb aboard. British intelligence believes that to be the case, and the British foreign minister now has banned British aircraft from flying in or out of Sharm el-Sheikh, the airport in the Sinai that the Russian jet departed from, because they don't consider the place secure enough. And, of course, that's a huge blow to General Sisi, the general in charge of Egypt, who's just had a state visit to England to repair his international reputation and boost trade. And clearly the Egyptians are very sensitive about how this is going to impact their tourism industry. I take it that Vladimir Putin would also be very sensitive about this as well, wouldn't he not, in terms of Russian reaction to whether or not this was the work of the Islamic State in retaliation to Russia's intervention in Syria. What's your sense of how that reaction will play out in Russia?
Well, Putin's already given us a hint with his recent statement today that basically Russians will not be intimidated, and I think that that's generally, I think, what the bottom line will be. Russians are in some ways a little bit like the Brits in this regard, and I don't think they're going to let this get to them, and I don't think it's going to spark any major uprising against Putin if this turns out to be a jihadi organized plot, which it increasingly looks like it is. And I don't think Putin's in a position to control the reporting completely inside Russia. The extent to which the administration and the extent to which the Putin clans control the media is a bit overstated. There are all sorts of talk shows on Russian television, including state-owned television, where alternative points of view are allowed to be expressed, including Americans who are very anti-Putin appearing on these shows. And then you have programs like Echo Moscow. So a lot of this is exaggerated in our media. Yes, Russia and the Kremlin controls state television, but again, there are many points of view that are allowed on the air. As I mentioned, you have many, again, anti-American, anti-Putin Americans appearing live on the air and spouting very anti-Putin lines, and you know, it just goes on and on. I watch these shows every week.
Well, but I think the real question is how do you think the Russian people feel about it? They already had, two wars in the Caucasus against the Chechens. There is the very work that you do, Gordon Hahn, is on researching the extent of Russia's Islamist threat from within. So
right.
That would be the real question, isn't it? Will this stimulate and energize the threat from within?
There's no doubt about that. The Syrian intervention will, the Russian Syrian intervention will give a small boost to jihadism in the North Caucasus. But this has been a long and ongoing story. And in fact, over the last 3 or 4 years, the number of attacks inside Russia has been steadily declining because since 2012, most of the Mujahideen have been going to Syria and Iraq, so the numbers of attacks in the North Caucasus are actually going down. The big downside is that this past summer, about 70 to 80% of the emirs and Mujahideen of the Caucasus Emirate Group, which is based in the North Caucasus, broke with the Caucasus Emirate and declared their loyalty to the Islamic State and established what they call the Caucasus Vilayat, or province of the Islamic State in Russia's North Caucasus. And as far as we know, they have remained in the North Caucasus. There have been a few minor attacks, which may have been organized by this group. And then the old Caucasus Emirate, which is allied with Al-Qaeda against the Islamic State, also remains in the North Caucasus. So you have these two persistent threats. Again, they've been there for a long time. They've been sharply weakened over the last few years by the defection, the exodus to Syria and Iraq. And I expect that there'll be a slight boost. And, of course, if this is a successful attack, it might help in their recruiting. But, again, this shouldn't be overstated. It has to remember, it's very important to remember that jihadists are on the offensive. They are not reacting to us. What they do because they believe in it. And their plan is to attack and carry out terrorist attacks. So you may see a shift in, you know, where they target because of certain events. So for example, if Russia intervenes in Syria, some attacks might target Russia instead of attacking, say, some European-associated target. But generally speaking, they're going to be attacking everyone who's not to their liking at some point. So it's important not to overstate this, that suddenly there's going to be a flood of attacks. And in fact, last time I was on your show, I predicted anyway that I thought with the formation of the Islamic State affiliate in North Caucasus, we would begin to see the suicide bombings begin to appear in the North Caucasus in Russia again, and that's probably on the horizon.
And again, I'm speaking with Gordon Hahn, who's a professor and researcher in the Terrorism Research and Education Program at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies at Monterey. He has taught at several universities in the United States and as a Fulbright Scholar at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. And his books include Russia's Islamic Threat. And his latest book is The Caucasus Emirate and Mujahideen, Global Jihadism in Russia's North Caucasus and Beyond. Now, I understand that the Russians don't allow jihadists who've gone off to join the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda to return to Russia. I mean, for some reason or other, the Europeans still allow these people to come back. And obviously they put the intelligence services on their trail, but that clearly didn't work for the Charlie Hebdo people in Paris. So what's your understanding of what measures are being taken in Russia to prevent the kind of blowback that's likely to happen from their intervention in Syria?
Well, if a Mujahid returns from Syria or Iraq to the North Caucasus, in almost all cases, if the security services find out about it, they're going to arrest him and detain him, and he'll go to prison. There might be a few cases where they'll leave someone out there to track them, to lead them to other Mujahideen, but the general practice is to arrest them. But that doesn't mean that some are not getting back and remaining free. This is certainly a threat. The borders between, for example, Azerbaijan, northern Azerbaijan and the North Caucasus are very porous. Between Georgia and the North Caucasus are very porous. So all someone has to do is get out of Syria or Iraq, go to Turkey, and then fly to Georgia or Azerbaijan, and then they can make it through the mountains to get back into the North Caucasus if they don't want to fly back into Moscow or St. Petersburg or Grozny or wherever. It's certainly not, you know, it's certainly a permeable defense line that the Russians have set up.
Right. Well, you know, I must say that the Islamic State, assuming that they're having claimed credit for this, pans out, obviously it's probably not that difficult to get a bomb aboard at Sharm el-Sheikh, because I don't think it's the Egyptian military are necessarily that much on the ball, given that they're dealing with an insurgency there in any case. And this looks like a very soft spot. You know, the feeling you have is that some decision was made by the Islamic State after Russia's intervention. Okay, we're going to pay them back. And not that they're not actually dropping most of their bombs, as I understand, on al-Qaeda and al-Nusra and these other and the U.S. affiliated rebel groups as opposed to the Islamic State. But they have apparently bombed a few of them. And more recently, since the Islamic State's made some advances around Homs, they have been bombing them. But you get the impression that they put this thing together pretty quickly, found a soft spot, and pulled it off. I mean, they're fiendishly efficient, they seem to be, this IS crowd.
Well, they're certainly highly motivated. It remains to be seen when exactly this plot began to be organized. Who exactly organized? We don't know, for example, whether this was someone from the Caucasus Vilayet of the Islamic State or someone from the Islamic State more proper or someone from the Islamic State in Egypt, or in fact whether the Islamic State is actually trying to take credit for an attack carried out by an al-Qaeda affiliate. So we have to be a little careful. The video that they showed, for example, when they claimed responsibility, showed a missile taking down an airplane, which is now not the scenario that most of the intelligence services and analysts and transportation experts are discussing, and forensic experts are discussing. So we still have to be a little bit careful, I think, about giving Islamic State credit for this. But if it turns out that the Islamic State actually did carry this out, and if it was specifically done to target Russia after the intervention, then certainly we have a serious problem on our hands, because that means in a very relatively short period of time they were able to mobilize sufficient resources, organize and plan this, and carry it out successfully. And that does not bode well for the flood of refugees, the situation in Europe with the flood of refugees going in there from Syria and other places. So there's a lot to worry about on that score.
Well, just in closing, what's your sense then, Gordon, of whether this is going to in any way affect Putin's apparent determination to prop up Assad?
I think this will have no effect on Putin's determination to do that whatsoever. Now, if there's turned out to be a series of attacks lasting over months or years, then that calculus might change. But even then, you would probably need to see the emergence of a strong opposition movement, demonstrations, and so forth. And I don't see that as being in the cards, because many Russians are very much concerned about global jihadism. They've had a direct experience with it over the last 15 years or so, 20 years. So I think there's a certain concurrence in views between the administration there and the bulk of the population. So I don't perceive there being a big problem.
Well, Gordon Hahn, I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Gordon Hahn, who's a professor and researcher in the Terrorism Research and Education Program at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies at Monterey. He has taught at several universities in the United States and as a Fulbright Scholar at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. And his books include Russia's Islamic Threat, and his latest book is The Caucasus Emirate and Mujahideen, Global Jihadism in Russia's North Caucasus and Beyond. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with the author of the new book, The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is Stephen Lee Myers, who has worked at the New York Times for 26 years, seven of them in Russia, during the period when Vladimir Putin consolidated his power. He spent 2 years as bureau chief in Baghdad, covering the winding down of the American war in Iraq, and now covers national security issues. His new book, just out, is The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Lee Myers.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I think Putin presents a unique problem in geopolitics, and in as much as his regime represents a combination of national security and organized crime, the mafia, and nuclear weapons. And it seems to me that the West still hasn't got its head around how to deal with this guy. And of course, since his intervention in Syria, a lot of our punditry praising him for being resolute, at the same time castigating President Obama for being feckless.
You know, if you think about it, for a quarter century, we in this country especially, but also in Europe, thought the Cold War was over, that the Soviet Union was no more, that a weakened Russia would integrate itself into the global community, global economy, and that you wouldn't have a kind of confrontation anymore, certainly not at the level that we did in the Cold War. And what we've seen happening, I think, recently, and Syria is a punctuation mark on it, I think, of something that was happening over some time, is the reemergence of Russia with a leader who is determined to play the role that the Soviet Union did, or at least something like that, to be a power again, to be respected, to be feared. And that's where you've seen a growing confrontation between Putin and the West, Putin and the United States in particular, over spheres of influence, which is, again, something we thought was from the last century, not something in the new world. But he's very much asserting that right of Russia to have areas that are where it has dominance. And that applies, of course, to Ukraine. And now we've seen for the first time since the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia projecting power beyond the former Soviet borders with the intervention in Syria.
So, but how much do you think this is personal as opposed to political, in the sense that Obama, who apparently used to talk to him fairly regular at length on the phone, just cut him off pretty much dead after Crimea and has tried to sort of, I guess, ostracize him. And I think after the Malaysian airliner, there was no question that he was ostracized at the G20 meeting in Brisbane, Australia, where he literally had to sit alone at the lunch table. Nobody would sit with him. So you get the feeling that he's basically saying to the world, particularly with an intervention in Syria, like, you can't ignore me.
That's, I think, exactly right. I mean, he's asserting himself in the center of the stage. I mean, with Obama, relations have never been good. to be honest, because during that period when he handed the reins, at least officially, of the presidency over to Dmitry Medvedev, Obama dealt with Medvedev and had not a poor relationship. They made some progress on arms control and so forth, the reset, they famously mm-hmm. called it. And it was when Putin came back to the presidency, single-handedly, it was his decision. The election after that was just a mere ratification of something he'd already decided. That's when relations were in the tank already, because I think there was a palpable disdain in the Obama administration, or maybe dismay, that Putin had returned, because there was hope that Russia had continued on this path. Bumpy, but still a transition. And for Putin to come back signaled that it was going to be a much harder line, that there wasn't going to be this forward progress as much as people in the United States and Europe had hoped. Relations with the U.S. and with Obama personally went south with Edward Snowden showing up in Moscow. So even before the events in Ukraine, that's when he had canceled the meeting he was supposed to have with Putin. And there were already tensions over Syria then. And then with the intervention in Ukraine, of course, there was a real break, and not just with the U.S., with Angela Merkel and Germany. I think Putin miscalculated the reaction to the annexation of Crimea, something that, again, is from a previous era. It's not something we look on kindly in the modern world, modern politics and diplomacy. And since then, of course, with the plane being shot down, you know, he was, I think, ostracized much more than he expected. And it was, I'm told, a shock to the people in the Kremlin, people around him, the degree of isolation. And it unfortunately fed into a paranoia that you see in the Kremlin now of enemies out to get Russia, and that all of this has somehow been orchestrated to keep Russia weak. And Putin reacts, you mentioned earlier, it seems personal in a way. It's like he's aggrieved in some way and needs to assert himself, almost as though he has been offended. Of course, not recognizing the steps that Russia's taken to contribute to this isolation. But nonetheless, you know, he's very belligerent on the world stage right now, but also very determined and assertive. And I think if you look at the history of the uprisings that we call the Arab Spring, that began in Tunisia and Libya, he saw those as a direct threat to the Kremlin in ways that I don't think we really appreciated here, because the idea of the street rising up in protest is what he fears most. He fears it in Russia, and he's talked about this. He's experienced it. He was in Dresden when the Berlin Wall came down and they stormed the Stasi headquarters. So this idea of the mob taking over from the legitimate authority of the state is something that deeply alarms him. And I think for the first time, unlike in Libya when Medvedev was still president, Russia drew a line and said, we're not going to let this happen to Syria, to the Assad mm-hmm. government. And that's why you've seen this intervention.
Well, I've heard that Putin was really angry with Medvedev. He felt that he got taken in by the U.S. and NATO.
I devote a whole chapter to that, explaining, I believe it's the reason that Putin came back. Some people close to him, including Medvedev, believed that he would stand for another term, Medvedev would. But it was after the intervention, the NATO intervention in Libya, where under great pressure from the U.S., Russia abstained in the United Nations Security Council to allow that mission to go forward, and Putin was infuriated. It was the first time that really that they had broken in public. They served, as they called it, a tandem. Putin criticized the president, and Medvedev felt he had to respond. And from that moment onward, the rest of that year in 2011, you could see Medvedev's stature diminished day by day until the moment when Putin announced, again, single-handedly, that he was going to come back and be the next president.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Lee Myers, who has worked at the New York Times for 26 years, seven of them in Russia during the period when Putin consolidated his power. He spent 2 years as bureau chief in Baghdad, covering the winding down of the American war in Iraq, and now covers national security issues. And his new book just out is The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin. And just in terms of the very present, where the latest on the Russian airliner that went down over the Sinai seems to be more and more indicating that that it was a bomb. It would seem to me that that's the last kind of narrative that Putin wants out there, that it might well be blowback for his intervention in Syria. Do you think he can contain the damage? I know he's got extraordinary control over the media, and they've almost created an alternative universe in Russia with their own Kremlin narrative. Can they manage this if it turns out to be the way it looks like it was, which was likely a bomb, and perhaps one planted at Sharm el-Sheikh by Islamic State or their agents?
You know, first of all, it's a terrible tragedy, of course, for an airliner full of, you know, Russians going down there for their, you know, winter holidays, most of them from St. Petersburg. Can Putin endure this? The short answer is yes, and they have. They've seen in Russia terrorist attacks of horrific scale and brutality. If you remember the theater siege in Moscow in 2002, the school in Beslan, 334 people were killed, most of them school children, in terrorist attacks by Islamic radicals that were at least initially affiliated with the Chechen independence movement, stemming out of the two wars that have been fought there since the collapse of the Soviet Union. So terrorism is not new to Russia, and Putin often talks about that. And he's talked about his intervention in Syria as being a necessity to halt the spread of the Islamic State before it moves into Russia itself, which sounds perhaps far-fetched, but there have been some reports of that already in the southern republics of Russia that are predominantly Muslim. Most of them now, especially with the war in Chechnya being largely over, most of them still quite stable and quite loyal to Russia, but there is that undercurrent of radicalism that's spread there as it has in many other countries. And I think Putin will use this, not necessarily cynically, but perhaps cynically, as a way to justify the intervention. Look who we're fighting against will be the message that comes out of this. They'll blow up an innocent airliner. They have before. Two planes went down a few days before the school was seized in Beslan in 2004. So because of the control of the narrative, you won't see a lot of public questioning of that because the Kremlin line will be consistent, and then that will permeate certainly television, but even print media and radio and so forth. So I think he'll be able to use it to justify what he's been doing.
But what I find personally sort of frightening about Putin is the very real possibility that what brought him to power, which was the demolition of apartment buildings in Moscow, where there's an enormous amount of evidence to suggest that maybe it wasn't the Chechens, but some state authorities. That is a hideous possibility if it's proven correct, and all those that have looked into it have died one way or the other, pretty much. That's beginning to be a part of the sort of narrative about who this guy really is. In terms of the Moscow theater, one of the things that was most alarming to me about that was that all of those innocent Russians that died because they didn't provide Narcan, which is what you give junkies when they OD on heroin, on the basis that the gas that was used was a state secret. And to me, that just, again, is that extraordinary callousness about the state is more important than the individual. The handling of the Kursk, there were also elements of that in the handling of the Kursk. So do you accept the idea that, or do you agree to some extent that that's something to have genuine disquiet about?
I think there's no question. If you look at the pattern of government behavior, I mean, it's easy to blame everything on Putin, but there does seem to be a reflex in the security ministries in particular, the military, of course, the intelligence services, which are usually quite secretive to start with, but a disregard for public accountability is what it is. And, you know, people have looked at the apartment bombings. They see it as kind of an original sin of the Putin era. At the same time, you know, there are other explanations, other alternatives, but they've never been explained. And so it's never been put to rest. What really happened? The Kursk, I think we mostly know, but largely because foreign submarines were monitoring the operation, and they lied and lied and lied for days on end. They lied to Putin, by the way, the military did. And so I think, you know, there is that pattern for the entire bureaucracy to obfuscate. I mean, the first instinct, I think, that even now with the intervention in Ukraine, it's riddled with lies.
They've classified
the fact of soldiers being killed is now a classified secret. And that is all to keep information from the public. And it's remarkably successful. Some gets out. People who want to find out can find out. You know, there still are voices, independent voices in Russia, online particularly, but even on the radio and some other media. But the disregard that you were talking about for the public, for the individual, is really something quite striking in Russian culture, and I think it dates back before Soviet times even, and it's deeply ingrained. And there was this moment, I think, in the early 90s when Russia embraced a kind of democratic transition, at least initially, where people wanted to be able to have some agency in their country. They wanted to be able to vote. They wanted to be able to worship freely, which they can do now, certainly more than they could before. Through Putin's personality and how that's trickled down into the instincts of the bureaucracy, that's been suppressed again, I think.
The gulag of the Russian mind, as Nina Khrushcheva describes it.
Yes, I've heard her say that many times, and there's a truth to it, you know, that the many Russian people, I was talking to some Russians just the other day about this, feel that they don't have an influence. They don't have a say, and they're trapped in their own kind of world. There are these opposition people who continue to resist. They write, they agitate, you know, they try to form campaigns and all this, but they're up against an overwhelming bureaucracy and this apathy that Nina's describing with that phrase.
Well, but I think in terms of our culpability in the West, and I'm not sure how far it goes, but clearly, having spent trillions of dollars, in quotes, winning the Cold War, we certainly weren't there to secure the victory in the follow-on. And when the ruble collapsed, that was a traumatic experience for the Russian people, particularly given their brief introduction to freedom and democracy and a market economy.
Do you mean in 98?
Yeah.
I think that...
I mean, they always cite that as being totally traumatic. And it was, you know, the oligarchs, of course, put their money into dollars, and the ruble collapsed, and everybody got hosed.
You know, there's no question that for Russia, the 1990s were a very rough period. A lot of people starved, literally. A lot of people were cheated out of whatever wealth they had. The people who were clever and connected did better. Some became incredibly wealthy, the oligarchs you mentioned. The question I've had, and I'd push back a little bit on the narrative that this is all somehow the United States' fault. You know, Russia had a lot to do with the country it's become. Boris Yeltsin did as a leader. You know, has the United States under now three administrations made mistakes in dealing with Putin? I think absolutely. But I can't see it being entirely something that the U.S. did wrong. And that's almost accepting Putin's way of looking at it.
Right.
That he sees the U.S. as behind every awful thing that happens, including the sanctions now, including the oil price falling, that's some conspiracy by the White House to keep Russia weak. And it's just preposterous, I think.
Right, but there was an element of dancing in the end zone. I think that
there's no question about that, and there will be people who will say that by expanding NATO, for example, to include countries that were not only once part of the Warsaw Pact but actually part of the Soviet Union, in the case of the three Baltic nations, that was provocative. And the Russians often say that Gorbachev had been promised that there would be no NATO expansion, which in fact there's no record of, and so whatever promises there were inferences, or perhaps something that Gorbachev misunderstood. But that said, Russia joined NATO in the Russia-NATO Council under the Clinton administration. I mean, there were efforts made to, even as NATO expanded, to not direct its focus or its defense strategy at Russia. Again, as I said in the beginning, it seemed like the Cold War was over. And if you look at defense spending in Europe, it plummeted after the Cold War. Our defense spending has gone down. I think that there was an opportunity perhaps missed to manage that relationship better. Under President Bush, a very divisive moment came when he abrogated the ABM treaty, the anti-ballistic missile treaty from the 70s, which is really a kind of cornerstone of arms control. And it's seen as something very destabilizing because of the ability to block a nuclear strike. And I think Russia's nuclear forces had reached a point in that very chaotic period where they perhaps weren't strong enough to really overcome even a limited system. And they vehemently opposed that. And Bush tried to talk them into it. Bill Clinton tried to talk them into it. And until Bush just decided he was going to break this treaty because it's, you know, it's very important and conservative ideology to have this going back to the Reagan years. So that was something I think began the break with Putin and the U.S. Really as early as 2001.
But from the point of view of the Russian people, it's not hard to understand why they support Putin so much and why they see him as a virile, strong leader compared to Yeltsin. He was deeply embarrassing, you know, stumbling around drunk and surrounded by a bunch of sycophants. Not to suggest that Putin himself is not surrounded by, you know, the Siloviki, his KGB pals who are stealing the country blind, you know.
Most leaders suffer from sycophants surrounding them. But the, you know, you're right. I mean, in fairness to Yeltsin, he wasn't just drunk. He had a heart problem. I mean, but he was certainly ailing, and he was his time had come. And he was a great historic figure, I believe, Boris Yeltsin, in making that transition from the Soviet Union. And it could have been a lot more destabilizing than it was, really. And he deserves credit for that. But you're right that when Putin came along, when he picked Putin as a strong man he thought would basically assure his personal safety, his legal safety, because he was under investigation for scandals that reached right to the Kremlin. The contrast with this new leader, who is kind of a gray figure, certainly a behind-the-scenes operator, but, you know, he was young, he was fit. Some women say he's handsome. And, you know, he seemed to be energetic and new, and he began that way. He did a lot of reforms. He acted very aggressively in the war that began in Chechnya days before he was appointed prime minister. And he, he pursued that conflict in a way that the political elite thought was dangerous. No one wanted to go back into war with Chechnya because the first war had been such a disaster for Russia and disaster for Yeltsin. But Putin went in and, confounding all expectations, won great approval for acting as forcefully as he did. So some of it is the image making that he does, and he admits it now, that these stunts and, you know, riding shirtless on a horse and swimming in the rivers in Siberia and flying with cranes and wrestling tigers and so forth, that these are all part of creating what he says is a positive image. Sometimes they seem preposterous to me, but they're quite convincing to ordinary Russians. And there's an element in Russia, I think, that particularly because of not just the 90s, but the decay at the end of the Soviet Union, when everything was falling apart, that they just want to be a strong country again. Mm. And they like it when he stands up to Obama, which is how it's portrayed in the Russian media, whatever the issue, you know, Ukraine, Syria. They cheer him as, you know, somebody who's resolute in Syria, is fighting the terrorists. Obama couldn't do it over a year of bombing and so forth.
Well, but that's apparently the narrative or the disconnect here, that Obama thinks Putin's a thug and Putin thinks Obama's a weakling. So we're in trouble, aren't we, in terms
of... The personal animosity between the two is striking.
Yeah.
Usually leaders at that level will try to keep it in check.
Right.
But there's no denying the disdain each feels for the other. And it's mutual. I believe that. Whether or not they can still work together, there were some signs this summer when they were in agreement on the Iran nuclear deal. There's some hope of a negotiated solution to the civil war in Syria, which I think everybody would welcome at this point after so many deaths there. But whether or not they can overcome that remains to be seen.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, just back to, and I know your book really does bring much of this to light. You know, you talked about the humiliation that he felt when the wall collapsed and the Stasi was overrun. He was helpless and there was nobody at home in Moscow. And all they could take back from Eastern Europe was a washing machine. And he was absolutely destitute, as were most of the Russian people. You know, Leipzig was not a great posting for a KGB guy. The really talented ones were in Europe and in the NATO capitals and in the United States. So I've never got the impression that he was a particularly talented intelligence officer. And like a lot of wannabes, he sort of exaggerates his role in retrospect. And, you know, so much of his focus seems to be like the going back to that KGB focus, which was on the what they call the main enemy, the United States. And it feels to me that so much that of what his reflexes are go back to that notion of the main enemy, that rather than build Russia and make it strong and successful and prosperous, his first priority seems to be, I'm going to get the Americans one way or the other. Is that your sense?
It is, but I would tweak it slightly in that I think he thinks the U.S. is trying to get him. And that it's not that he's after the U.S. I think he wants a partnership with the West, but on his terms. He wants Russia to be respected. He wants his sphere of influence,
but
which includes Ukraine.
But how much is that
Ukraine.
Not a metaphor for himself, being respected?
I think it's absolutely a metaphor for his own stature, his own
right.
feeling of the need for respect, the struggle to have it. You know, I mean, he's not a big man. He talks about his childhood as though he were a tough guy, but it's pretty clear he was probably bullied himself, and that he even says that he learned martial arts. He took it up as a teenager in order to defend himself. Right. And you see this often in his reaction to events, a kind of insecurity and the need to demonstrate the power, not weakness, you know, that he sees that a weak government, like a weak man being, you know, a dangerous thing because then they can't control, create stability, which is what his, I think, primary goal always is.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us. I've really enjoyed the conversation, Stephen Lee Myers.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
And again, Stephen Lee Myers has worked at the New York Times for 26 years, seven of them in Russia during the period when Putin consolidated his power. He spent 2 years as bureau chief in Baghdad, covering the winding down of the American war in Iraq, and now covers national security issues. His new book just out is The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how oil industry money killed a bill to reduce gasoline consumption in California.
Now the deep water horizon descends down to death's door, and at the bird's foot, they've lost all hope. 'Cause oil is a drifting for miles and miles, poisoning the Gulf of Mexico.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud. And if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. 'Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Adrienne Alvord, who is the Union of Concerned Scientists, California and Western States Director, working to ensure a clean, decarbonized energy and fuel economy that promotes equitable economic growth and improves public health in the Western states. She just wrote a piece at the Union of Concerned Scientists blog, Oil Industry Money Buying Too Much Influence in California. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adrienne Alvord.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And the third quarter expenses lobbying figures have just come out, and we now know why at least one important part of Governor Brown's efforts to address climate change in California, the idea that we would be cutting its gasoline consumption with trucks and automobiles by 50% by the year 2030. That was scuttled. Brown was obviously annoyed, but he vowed to fight on. But my understanding is that the oil companies essentially bought a lot of the junior legislators on the Democratic side. They already had all of the Republicans in their pocket, and that's what killed the bill. They didn't even have their fingerprints on it because it didn't even go to a vote.
Well, I will say that the oil company campaign appears to be the latest example of a pattern of disinformation and really spending a fortune on misinformation that's going back at least three decades now. And the purpose of this is to stop or slow effective climate action. And unfortunately, in this instance, I would say they were partially successful. I think we're fortunate in California that the policies we already have on the books will actually get us about halfway there. They'll get us to about 24% reduction. Of course, the oil companies are fighting those as well. And we were unable, this time around at least, to get a 50% reduction by 2030 in statute. But I have a feeling that this is not going away, that we'll be seeing, you know, I think our side at least is very much in favor of continuing this initiative.
Well, Governor Jerry Brown said oil won the skirmish, but they've lost the bigger battle. Now, in terms of the oil companies, and we're talking about BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and Shell, they have all recently admitted or conceded that climate change is real. So clearly they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. On the one hand, they're acknowledging climate change and that presumably they're not going to continue to fund climate change deniers, although I'm not sure about that. But on the other hand, here they are behind the scenes, you know, buying politicians to make sure that anything to deal with climate change is scuttled.
That certainly appears to be the case in government, certainly at the federal level and also in California that we've seen this year. We also saw their fingerprints on some attempts to roll back some good clean fuel policies in Oregon, and they appear to be active in Washington as well, trying to prevent clean fuel standards in that state. So they're all over the West Coast trying to prevent more progressive policies, and things are just kind of locked down at the federal level. But again, there is room for good news here in that the laws that we already have, as I said, are really taking us on the way to reducing our petroleum use. And what's interesting is that petroleum use nationally, demand has been flat. People are really not using as much per capita as they have been in the past, and this has been going on for several years now, including into the recovery. So this isn't just a question of a downturn in economic activity. People really are using less fuel, and that's something that I think is going to be a long-term problem for the petroleum industry. There's too much oil. That's one of the reasons we've seen a collapse in prices. They're simply producing too much for the demand right now.
So what do you think then is the next step for Governor Brown? Because he's made it clear that big oil may have won a skirmish, but they're not going to win the war. So what's the next battle?
Governor Brown actually has a great deal of executive authority to implement the policies that we need to reduce our oil use. And while the oil companies tried to invent all kinds of exotic and frightening things that government was going to do to reduce oil use, like, you know, new taxes and preventing people from driving, all of which were nonsense, the fact is that the policies that we have today are what we need to reduce our oil use 50%, which are increasing vehicle efficiency, which we're already doing, reducing the vehicle miles traveled in vehicles, basically making transit options more available and improving local planning. I think greater adoption of alternative fuels, which is, you know, biofuels and a lot of electric vehicles. Electrifying the fleet is really kind of the secret ingredient we need to really, really reduce our oil use substantially over the next decades.
So, in terms of what I was mentioning about how they bought off the legislature and the legislators, particularly the Democrats, because they already had all the Republicans in their pocket, didn't have to even go to vote so that they couldn't be named and shamed. Clearly, that worked. But they also, basically had a huge propaganda campaign to frighten the Californian consumers into thinking that the sky was going to fall. That's clearly, which, so I guess it was a 1-2 punch there, right?
I think that's correct. The campaign that the oil companies waged this summer was really aimed at consumers, and the message was that the government is going to raise prices, the government's going to make it more more difficult for you to drive. There were all kinds of horror stories. There were extreme scenarios that they tried to present as plans for reducing oil use, and it was basically made up. It was kind of surprising that they were so creative. I mean, I hadn't really seen anything like it before. And that created, I think, an environment in which legislators could say that, you know, they were getting calls from their constituents about this and they were worried, and that gave them kind of cover, if you will, to not support these provisions.
Well, specifically in terms of the legislators, in terms of lobbying the legislators, the oil companies during the fight over the bill, SB 350, the one that would have had a provision to cut the consumption of oil or gasoline in cars and trucks in California by 50% by the year 2030, the Western States Petroleum Association paid for assembly members Rudy Salas, a Democrat of Bakersfield, Jim Frazier, a Democrat of Oakley, and Mike Gibson, a Democrat of Carson, to stay at the Ritz-Carlton in Half Moon Bay during a conference that they put on, 3 weeks after the legislative session ended, and all three lawmakers had expressed reservations about the oil reduction target. There's at least there's some reporting about who was bought off here. Kevin DeLeon, of course, was the author of the bill. I don't know. I guess he wasn't able to whip his people into shape there. But it is depressing to see how effective big money is.
Well, what's interesting to me is that the utility industry, which was also very affected by SB 350 in provisions to increase our energy to 50% renewables by 2030, which is, you know, compelling them basically to purchase renewable energy, they ended up either neutral or in support of the bill. And I think it's interesting that the utility industry has figured out a way to make low-carbon energy work for them. These are people that are also in the business of making a profit. And they've decided more or less to get with the program. They want to do it in a way that's most profitable for them, and they don't perhaps agree with everything that some of us might like to see in terms of renewables. But they are certainly cooperating and trying to make these policies work. And that's in contrast to the oil industry, which really has been so reluctant. They say, as you mentioned, that they understand climate change is happening, and they've made noises that they want to be constructive. And yet, you know, we really do need to move very aggressively and very quickly. There's a time component in terms of how quickly we need to move to reduce emissions pretty aggressively. And they just don't agree to the kinds of policies that we really need to address the issue. That's what's really too sad. In terms of Senator De Leon, I would point out that the Senate actually supported SB 350, and it was Assembly Democrats specifically who had who objected, and not all of them, but a group of moderate Democrats who had objections to the oil reduction provisions.
Well, you call them moderate Democrats. I'm sure a lot of our listeners would consider them traitors. And I have to add Henry Pereira to that list, a Democrat of Fresno. Is there round two then in terms of, you say there's enough laws on the books to make this happen, which would then make one ask, well, why need SB 350? I mean, clearly there's a need to ramp up the efforts. I mean, climate change is not going away. It's getting more and more intense. And California has a massive problem with a drought. and the fact that traditionally California's was able to bank its water in the Sierras in the form of snow, and now they can't anymore because of global warming. And then we're expecting a big El Nino this year, this coming year, where we'll have enormous amounts of rain in Southern California. Almost all of that water is going to go out into the ocean. Very little of it's going to be stored. It's not going to help the Sierras from what most of the forecasters tell us. So we have a real crisis in this state, and there's a direct connection to global warming. So a lot of these assemblymen who come from rural states that are having a terrible problem with the drought that's affecting the agriculture sector are nevertheless voting along with the oil companies who are part of the problem, not a part of the solution.
Well, as you're pointing out, we have terrible challenges that we need to face in California and elsewhere. Certainly water is high on the list for us because of the drought we've been having and the anticipated deluge that is possibly going to follow this year. The thing that I want to point out about Governor Brown's authority, he has executive authority to continue and perhaps intensify his policies, but he is not going to be our governor forever. His term is up in 2018, and unless these policies are made law, you know, the next governor can come in and stop or even reverse progress. So that's really why I think we need a law in California and elsewhere to ensure that we have aggressive policies to reduce our use of fossil fuels for energy and other uses. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if the legislature has an appetite to do this or if we're going to just do executive action. But ultimately, we really need to make this the law of the land. So for all the reasons you mentioned and for future generations, it's very important that we move aggressively and soon.
Well, but in terms of the disconnect where you have a lot of the Democrats in the Assembly who represent rural areas and where big ag is being really impacted by the drought, they're not making the connection then, are they? I mean, it's as I say, the biggest problem that California has with the drought is the fact that we can't bank the snow in the Sierras because of global warming, and that's just real. And El Nino is not going to save us. I'm just astounded that they don't see the connection. That it makes no sense to support big oil when your very constituents, the farmers, are running out of water.
You know, it's interesting. The extremity of the impacts we're starting to see, I think, is starting to change people's perception about climate change. For a long time, I think people thought it was something that would happen elsewhere or something that would happen a very long time from now. And people are really kind of waking up because they're seeing it and feeling it in their daily lives. This is a hard thing to measure. I don't have any data for you that says, you know, that public opinion has changed X amount because of the impacts they're experiencing. But certainly, anecdotally, I believe that people are really, you know, the oil companies themselves are coming out and saying, yeah, this is something real and something that we have to deal with. So it's going to be interesting to see how the political process and the money in politics jives over the next few years with the fact that people are really starting to experience this. And we are seeing some changes. I just hope we can get those changes in the time frame that we need.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it very much.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Adrienne Alvord, who is the Union of Concerned Scientists, California and Western States Director, working to ensure a clean, decarbonized energy and fuels economy that promotes equitable economic growth and improves public health in Western states. She just wrote a piece at the Union of Concerned Scientists blog, Oil Industry Money, Buying Too Much Influence in California. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.